First, I just want to join the chorus of voices honoring Between the Lines Radio. What an incredibly important news organization this is, and the fact that it's been able to endure for 25 years in an atmosphere where the budgets of many news organizations that are actually reporting the news are either being diminished or reallocated to sort of a hybrid of reality television and, you know, celebrity personalities. And to have the diligence to keep going in a climate where a lot of people, I think, have been lulled into an apathetic state really is a testament to the quality of the volunteers and the workers in the community that make this radio program possible. And I look forward to being back in another 25 years to help celebrate the 50th anniversary of Between the Lines Radio. So congratulations to Scott and all of the team here. To talk about Donald Trump is sort of low-hanging fruit, and I think, you know, we could spend an entire 90 minutes talking about the dangers of a Trump presidency. Although with this latest leak of this video, with him saying these incredibly misogynistic, sexist things, but more important than that, bragging about his intent to commit sexual assault. It's not sexual abuse, it's not sexual harassment. What Trump bragged about was his intent and his ability to sexually assault women. And so when you read people like Jeb Bush or even Mike Pence, they frame their denunciations of Trump with, you know, as a grandfather, as a father, as a husband, as though that's some kind of a prerequisite to say this man is bragging of committing crimes and some of the more heinous crimes that an individual, particularly a man, can commit in this society. We could spend time talking about the fascistic and at times totally contradictory policy visions that Trump has tweeted out. And then when asked about it, it's, I didn't tweet that. And it's sort of, it reminds me, for those of you who were old Saturday Night Live fans, when they did the Harry Shearer played Mike Wallace and they did the fake 60 Minutes segment about defective whoopee cushions, and they were interviewing the lawyer for this sleazy company that was manufacturing bootleg whoopee cushions that were harming people's buttocks, Nathan Thurm, the lawyer, and every time Mike Wallace would present him with a fact, he would say, you know, it's you, it's not me, it's you. And it's sort of what we're seeing with Trump. And, you know, prior to this last scandal, I guess you could call it, that emerged last night about Trump on the bus with a member of the Bush family. Someone tweeted something pretty funny last night where they said, you know, who had money that Billy Bush would be the member of the Bush family that would have the biggest impact on this election? But, you know, the thing that I thought was interesting in how little attention it was getting is actually how dangerous the views and ideas and record of Mike Pence really, you know, if you flesh it out, it's a terrifying vision of the world. Mike Pence is someone who is responsible for the deaths of many HIV-positive people in his home state of Indiana. His refusal to accept that as a public health urgent situation that needed state organization to respond to. He is a radical Christian supremacist. In fact, he and Eric Prince, the founder or creator of Blackwater, are very good friends. When Blackwater mercenaries gunned down a dozen and a half Iraqis in Baghdad's Nisr Square in September of 2007, Mike Pence actually organized a welcoming party for Eric Prince to Capitol Hill soon thereafter, saying that he had been maligned and that the whole institution of government contracting was being maligned, and they organized, and Pence spearheaded this, a welcome Eric Prince to Capitol Hill party that a number of prominent Republicans participated in. And, you know, Pence, unlike, you know, Trump, I think, is someone who, if he was elected, would probably spend a good deal of his time running the White House Twitter feed and sexually harassing the interns and trying to sell steaks and bad ties and all of those things. And he has said that Mike Pence, he was going to, Mike Pence was going to be in charge of domestic and foreign policy and that he would take care of the rest. Not exactly sure what the rest would be in that case, but that actually is more frightening to me in some ways than if Trump actually was in charge, because if you you know, if you just sort of tweeted enough at him and made him think it sounded like a good idea, he would claim it as his own and decide not to invade Iran, and that he was very smart, tremendous job he did not invading Iran. But Pence is someone that I think actually does want the United States to invade Iran, does want the United States to use a nuclear weapon. On the issue of first strike that came up in the presidential debate, Mike Pence really went far away from the policies that Trump has, I don't want to say articulated, because that's not certainly not the right word, that Trump has sort of mentioned from time to time he believes in. But, you know, this is a guy, and now there's all this pressure for Pence to take over the top of the ticket, and, you know, that could be very difficult because voting has already opened up in some places. But Pence himself denounced Trump this morning. And said that, you know, he can't defend it, and it is indefensible. And there's all these Republicans that are now jumping ship and saying that Trump should withdraw from the top of the ticket. And it, at least now it doesn't seem like he's going to. But, in you know, we could look at this as a way of Mike Pence at least preparing himself for a 2020 run, both by his debate performance and the policies that he articulated, which are extremely hawkish, cold warrior, mixed with hot warrior in terms of the current situations in Syria and elsewhere in the world, his 2020 vision. And, you know, Pence is someone that is very much at the core of the radical religious right that permeates large sections of the Republican Party, particularly as they've evolved over the past 20, 30 years. So he's someone to watch out for, whether or not their campaign implodes. But on the issue of Hillary Clinton, you know, I'm kind of astonished at the lack of difficult questioning that she's endured during this presidential campaign, outside of the blatantly sexist, misogynistic, hateful lines of inquiry or attack that have been, you know, unleashed against Hillary Clinton. And I think there is no contradiction in, as a normal person in society, realizing that a great deal of the reasoning behind Hillary Clinton's dramatic unpopularity, particularly with men, has to do with sexism. And the Republicans have hated her from the moment that she entered political life. They've tried to destroy her. They use words to describe her they would never use to describe men. And I think that if Hillary Clinton was a man, this would be a landslide election against Donald Trump. Now, having said all of that and recognizing that she is the target of vicious, hateful, sexist, misogynistic lines of attack, she also is a reprehensible person on a policy level. And I think that one of the great failures of the Sanders campaign was not to go after how right-wing Hillary Clinton is much faster. Remember, Hillary Clinton wouldn't say Bernie Sanders' name for months. She was really hoping he was going to go away, or was going to sort of be like Dennis Kucinich, where he was just happy to be there in the debates. And then at the end of it, he gets like a daytime slot at the DNC that, you know, that no one watches. Well, Sanders actually raised a tremendous amount of money, enough to run a full national state-based campaign. And on some key issues, I think he really drew blood in the debate against Hillary Clinton, particularly on her connections to Wall Street, her relationship with big industry and wealthy donors, the corruption of the campaign finance system in this country. There's no question that Sanders did that. But is it because Sanders, it was some magical being? Was Hillary actually afraid of Bernie Sanders the person? No. What they were afraid of is if a national or international audience is allowed to hear the views that so many people in this country hold as important or true about what needs to change in this society, then things actually may change in this society. In a way, what I thought was the most important revelation from the Sanders campaign was that someone who articulates you know, basic ideas, progressive ideas, actually has a pretty wide range of support in this country. I liken it to what happened with Obamacare. I personally think, for me, Obamacare is a terrible thing. I mean, my premium has gone up. You know, it's awful. I didn't get to keep my doctors. I just got another email the other day saying that my premium is going to like almost double. However, for a lot of people in this country, Obamacare is a major improvement on what they had. For people who need to stay on their parents' health insurance, for people that had no health insurance, there was a real the pre-existing conditions. There was a real benefit provided to some of the more vulnerable people in our societies through Obamacare. Now, why am I bringing that up in the context of talking about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton? It's because when Republicans and Democrats and independents and others alike are asked about certain core components of Obamacare, they say they support it. But when they're asked if they support Obamacare, they say no. And that's a, you know, it's it, there's a partisan mentality on that. The same is sort of true in our electoral politics. When Bernie Sanders articulates ideas about the economy, about our campaign finance system, an enormous number of Americans agree with those things. And so it's not about Bernie Sanders. I mean, Bernie Sanders is actually kind of a curmudgeonly guy. I was actually shocked at how much charm he mustered up, because he's not charming, actually. And he's an old white guy. You know, and it sort of flashes of Nader in some ways, where it's like you wish that someone else was in that position who wasn't an old white man. But the point of this is, what was Hillary Clinton afraid of at the beginning of Sanders' campaign? She was afraid that she was going to be hit from a large, quieted group of people in this country who actually support progressive change, who don't want corporations running our electoral process in a macabre form of legalized bribery. And he posed a real threat. And I think that strategically, he made a big mistake by underestimating the Clinton machine, and he thought that he could sort of play clean with them. And only late in the game did he start to focus on a foreign policy level on the fact that Hillary Clinton was a key player in the regime change in Libya, when she was cavorting around with Henry Kissinger. Some of the comments that she made about Bernie Sanders that were blatant red-baiting attempts by trying to make it sound like he was a complete apologist for Daniel Ortega, and then twisted who Daniel Ortega, the head of the Sandinistas, who he actually was. What's kind of hilarious about that is that the Clintons were friendly with Daniel Ortega and his wife at the time, and Hillary Clinton went to, you know, gatherings with Daniel Ortega. Bernie Sanders went and heard him speak once. But the hypocrisy of Clinton's foreign policy and the hawkish sameness of the elite Republicans and the elite Democrats that leads to people like George H.W. Bush endorsing Hillary Clinton, Sanders almost didn't touch it at all. And the fact is that if you watched Tim Kaine debate Mike Pence the other night, Tim Kaine invoked Reagan and the 80s more often than Mike Pence. You know, it was like Saint Reagan has appeared and somehow anointed the Democrats now as his rightful successors. And to, I think, a great extent, on many policies, that's true. Hillary Clinton, on a foreign policy, represents sort of right-center Republican thinking from the late 80s, early 90s, including when the right up until when President Clinton was elected. They are kind of stuck in time. And if you look at who's endorsed Hillary Clinton, one person that should just be, on everyone's radar and that should be viewed as scandalous is John Negroponte, who was, of course, the U.S. ambassador to Honduras and the key official in Central America organizing the financing of the Contra death squads in Nicaragua. When the diplomatic cables from Negroponte's time in office as the ambassador to Honduras were obtained by the National Security Archive, they showed that not only was Negroponte meeting regularly with his good friend General Alvarez, who ran Battalion 316, the Honduran Army U.S.-backed intelligence unit that disappeared scores and scores of people, but that Negroponte was reporting that the human rights situation in Honduras was like Switzerland. One diplomat said that Negroponte makes it look like we're talking about Switzerland here, when in reality you had death squads in Honduras being supported by the United States through Negroponte in Honduras. You had Negroponte using Honduras as a staging ground to funnel all forms of support to the Contra death squads in Nicaragua. Negroponte then goes on to be George W. Bush's director of national intelligence, deeply implicated in the legitimizing of torture during that administration. And Hillary Clinton has put this guy's name on her website as someone she's proud to have the endorsement of, while her running mate, Tim Kaine, was just attacked last week because this right-wing Catholic lobbying group, Catholic Vote, said that he had spent time with a Marxist priest in Honduras. It actually kind of made me like Tim Kaine that this story came out. that Marxist priest that they were talking about, that Hillary Clinton's campaign never responded to, never denounced this attack on Tim Kaine. Tim Kaine, when he was a law student, went and volunteered in a Jesuit community in Honduras for 9 months. And during that time, when he was with the Jesuits, and remember what was going on, Catholic church women, including nuns, were being raped and murdered by U.S.-backed death squads in El Salvador and elsewhere. You had Jesuit priests being executed by graduates of the U.S. Army School of the Americas. You had Archbishop Oscar Romero shot dead while he was saying mass at a church, again, by two graduates of the U.S. Army School of the Americas. At that time, when Negroponte was the ambassador, Tim Kaine was there as a young Jesuit volunteer, and he went over to Nicaragua to seek out an American Jesuit priest named Father James Carney. Father James Carney, I had read when I was living at the Catholic Worker in the 90s, I read his memoirs, his autobiographies of becoming a revolutionary priest. And ultimately, James Carney renounced his U.S. citizenship, and he left the Order of the Jesuits because he felt that his the best use of his life in the world was to join with the campesinos and the revolutionaries who were fighting against U.S.-backed death squads and despot regimes in Central America at the time. And he went, Tim Kaine went for one meeting with Father James Carney, and that now has turned into a scandal where this lobbying group is saying, what did James Carney teach Tim Kaine? You know, it'd be like, what did Jeremy Scahill teach you that one time you went to see him speak somewhere? And then 35 years later, that somehow is like the skeleton in your closet after, you know, being pro-death penalty, against abortion, all of these things as a public official. Somehow there's a scandalous leftist inside of Tim Kaine. But that was a scandal. What was not a scandal is that while Negroponte, Hillary's endorser, was the ambassador of Honduras, Father James Carney was abducted by Negroponte's friends and killed by being thrown from a helicopter. Negroponte then covered up the involvement of U.S. advisors and the CIA in the assassination, or rather execution, of Father James Carney. Instead of saying, you know, any of this about her running mate and the attacks that he endured leading up to the vice presidential debate, she touts the endorsement of a man who covered up the murder of a U.S. citizen by a Honduran death squad by throwing him out of a helicopter. Hillary Clinton has more in common with the Contra death squads, when you look at her endorsements, than some former Contras have. I mean, she has the all-star team of people that were responsible for the vicious, dirty wars throughout Central and Latin America. She also has the neocons endorsing her. The Weekly Standard now loves Hillary Clinton, the official organ of the neoconservative movement. Max Boot, who has never met a war he didn't want someone else's kids to fight, is a prominent endorser of Hillary Clinton. There's a whole slew of some of the most reprehensible former U.S. officials and political figures that constitute a big core of Hillary Clinton's foreign policy endorsements. Who Donald Trump can point to are really the craziest of the crazy in the military. People like Jerry Boykin, General Jerry Boykin, who you know, said, our God is greater than Allah, and that's why we win. And, you know, really radical sort of crusader type guy. His top, Trump's top military advisor, General Mike Flynn, suggested that the U.S., if they feel it's effective, may consider killing the family members of suspected terrorists as a way of leveraging intelligence from them. Wants torture brought back, etc. But Hillary has the all-star teams. George H.W. Bush, former CIA director, a man deeply involved with the dirty wars in Central and Latin America, not only his time as CIA but as Reagan's vice president. Then you have, the Kagan brothers, who are, you know, the intellectual architects of the project for a new American century. And the only true scumbag that hasn't endorsed her yet is Donald Rumsfeld. And after this last tape, I wouldn't be surprised if Rumsfeld now endorses Hillary Clinton. And now why is, you want that to happen? I don't know. I mean, maybe there's some radical libertarian here who wants Gary Johnson to, after he figures out where Aleppo is, to really tell us how he's going to change the country. So I'm saying all this not as a sort of guilt by association thing, because these people, these right-wing, just vicious individuals, they're not endorsing Hillary Clinton because they're holding their nose to do it. Their core interest is the empire. Their core interest is corporate profits for the war industry, domination. Some of them really do view themselves as in a war to destroy Islam in the world. But they're not endorsing Clinton because it's like lesser of two evils. Hillary is who they want. Hillary is their candidate. They have everything in common with her on a foreign policy level, infinitely more than they do with Mike Pence or Donald Trump. It's not that Pence or Trump wouldn't be manipulated by them or they couldn't still push through with their agendas, but the Clintons are part of the politics of empire in this country. The Clintons and the Bushes, closest thing we have to monarchy, you know, business in this country. Hillary Clinton has supported all of these core war policies when it mattered. Later she'll say, oh, I made a mistake. You know, her explanation for voting for the Iraq war was totally ridiculous, saying she thought that they were voting for sending inspectors in. You know, first of all, that's just complete malpractice if you're a lawmaker and you thought that that's what that bill said. But also, if you listen to her speech on the floor supporting the invasion of Iraq, it was clear that she wanted regime change. Now, is it just about her time in the Senate? No. When her husband was president in 1998, and Bernie Sanders also endorsed this, they signed into law the Iraq Liberation Act, which made regime change in Iraq the law of the United States, which meant that it was the precursor for what Bush and Cheney ultimately did, because they had a bipartisan consensus that at some point we're going to overthrow this government. And Clinton signed this bill that was actually written by individuals who worked for the Project for a New American Century, the Rumsfelds of the world, wrote this. Clinton signs it into law. Sanders, by the way, did support that bill. And then you have the Republicans take power. 9/11 gives them the rationale in their minds that they need to go and invade Iraq. And the rest is history. But Hillary Clinton was totally supportive of that war even before it happened. And then later, when it became politically untenable because she was running against Barack Obama, who had carefully come out very narrowly in a qualified way, kind of, sort of, against the Iraq war because it was a stupid war. But if you listen to that speech from Obama when he really was starting to think about becoming president, October 2002, it is not an anti-war speech. It is a highly qualified opposition to a single U.S. war. And it was really brilliant politically, but it put Hillary into a very tough position because the perception was Obama's the anti-war candidate. He wasn't the anti-war candidate. He was the anti-Iraq war candidate compared to Hillary Clinton, who had voted for this thing. So when we talk about, you know, where we're at right now, you know, I understand why people are afraid of Trump. If somebody said to me, just on the issue, I'm not going to vote for the third party, just on the issue of Supreme Court justices, I do not want Donald Trump and Mike Pence to be in charge of choosing Supreme Court justices who probably will fight like hell to make women's health care, parts of women's health care, illegal in this country, i.e. abortion or certain forms of contraception. That's a real thing. I would never say to somebody, oh, you should vote third party. I'm less interested in sort of, are we voting for Hillary? Are we supporting Jill Stein? Are we supporting Gary Johnson? Then I am recognizing that until we actually address the dominant role that these corporations play in our political process, none of it is ever going to change. And that's why I think what happened with Bernie at the end was so disappointing. Imagine for a moment if instead of just completely imploding basically at the end, Bernie had said to Hillary, no, you know what, I'm not going to endorse you. And in fact, I'm going to run against you as a third party candidate. Fooled you, I'm not really a Democrat. Now, of course, Bernie then would be doomed to, you know, the kind of Nader syndrome where everybody says Ralph Nader lost the election, which by the way is total BS. But you know, Sanders, that would have been an enormous gamble. But imagine what the impact of it could have been if you had someone in this climate where you have a Trump running on the one side, then you have the empire candidate Hillary on the other, and you actually have someone who has gotten a tremendous amount of support for the ideas that he's putting forward. And the ideas he's putting forward are resonating because a lot of people agree with them. He wouldn't have won. He wouldn't have become president, but he would have scared the shit out of the Democrats. And what would they have done in that situation? They never, ever have to pay up for the support of people on the anti-war left because they can always say, do you want John McCain? Do you want Mitt Romney? And this time it's like, it's like Democrat Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa all wrapped in one. It's like, do you really want Donald Trump? I mean, Hillary's best line is, I'm not him. And that's the truth. But like, at what point is there going to be the political courage enough in our society to say, you know what, I don't care what people say. We need to challenge this once and for all. Sanders could have done that. He could have done that with his political capital and with the capital money that he had raised. Now, would that have meant that Trump won? I don't know. I think it would have meant that the Democrats would have had to really change their game and address the issue of campaign finance reform. Of course, it's just a pipe dream. No political figure that gets to that level will do that. And that's why this system endures. But someday, somebody has to take the risk to do that. So the subject that I was asked to speak about today, I'm probably like all of you guys, I'm just like completely immersed in the world of this election, and my God, I'm salivating over what's gonna, I mean, Trump might even show up tomorrow night. I mean, it's gonna be really, or if he tries to like grab Hillary, or so she could totally like, when he goes to shake her hand, she should just bat it away and say, you're not grabbing my, no, anyway. Yeah, or she could bring a Miss Piggy doll, or like, there's any number of ways in which it could just end up being fun, except I don't think that they'll do it. The greatest likelihood is that he doesn't come, although that wouldn't be very Trump-esque.